Now the Three Martini Lunch with Greg Corumbus and Jim Garrity.
And welcome to the Friday edition of the Three Martini Lunch. We're glad you survived the week along with us. And Jim, it was just yesterday that we were praising Chris Christie, the governor of New Jersey, for bringing his no-nonsense, tell-it-like-it-is message to Washington about just how horrific our debt situation is and just how serious we're going to have to be about trying to clean it up. Well, there's a lot of people who are elected governor across the country who are dealing with the very same thing. And one of them is dealing with large protests as a result of what he's trying to do here. And that's Scott Walker in Wisconsin, who's kind of taking a page out of the Christie playbook by asking public sector employees to contribute to their pensions, contribute a little bit more to their health care plan. In addition to Walker making the case, here's how one of our favorites, Paul Ryan, who's obviously the chairman of the House Budget Committee and a congressman from Wisconsin, is explaining exactly what Walker's trying to accomplish here.
They contribute next to nothing to their pensions, very, very little in their health care packages. He's asking that they contribute about 12% for their health care premiums, which is about half of the private sector average, and about 5.6% to their pensions. It's not asking a lot.
So now Ryan says with all these people marching on Madison, it looks like Cairo has moved to Wisconsin. But at a place like Madison, it's not hard to get the activists worked up, even though they may not have much of a clue about what's actually going on here. But kudos to Scott Walker for standing firm in what cannot be exactly what he expected in his first month on the job.
See, I look at this, Greg, and I think, let a thousand Christies bloom from coast to coast in every case. I noticed that John Kasich of Ohio was among those who were saying we're giving Walker a vote of confidence, and maybe we'll see similar things in that state. One of the things I'm kind of marveling at as we look at this is how much this really was not an issue until, I'd say, just really the last 2 years or so, until the severe economic recession and state budgets really got really terrible. You didn't hear about this much beyond maybe, the occasional talk radio callers and hosts, NR, AEI, Heritage, and Cato, and a few right-of-center think tanks. Yet bit by bit, the power of public sector unions, that more and more members of the private sector public are looking at this and saying, wait a minute, we have carried the burden of this recession. If you work in the public sector, by and large, you haven't noticed the recession. Life is still pretty good. You don't pay nearly as much for your health care. You generally have a pension, which are pensions are almost a thing of the past in the private sector. Most people have 401ks, and they go up sometimes, they go down sometimes. They certainly don't have that kind of stability. And so there's this sense of what's one of the major problems, impacting our economy as we're moving forward, is that effectively we have two economies. We have a private sector economy that, generates all of the wealth and carries almost all of the burden for the ups and downs. And then we have a public sector economy, which is extraordinarily generous and doesn't really have much variance. It goes up in bad times and it goes up in good times. So in a way, this is kind of a long overdue reckoning. And as you look at this, you hope we're not past the point of no return. The other thing which has kind of been fascinating to watch these teachers unions throw these tantrums, I would say, is the old pranks and the old stunts aren't working. You're not seeing the automatic sympathy. It certainly didn't turn that way in New Jersey. It's very similar to bringing out Arthur of PBS to Capitol Hill to pose with Democratic Congress members. That's a routine. Now, they've brought out Big Bird. They brought about every Muppet down to like Prairie Dawn over the years to protest any PBS cuts. Never mind that Sesame Street makes about $1 billion through merchandising. And so we're just one of those things like, I think these stunts are getting tired and they have a very predictable playbook. And I'm just not so sure that in year three, effectively, of economic hard times, Americans are quite as sympathetic and receptive to it as they ordinarily are.
Yeah.
And I don't want to put the cart before the horse. Still a long way to go. But so far, it seems like the public is not as receptive to the union message as it used to be.
Yeah, absolutely right. And the people of Wisconsin sent a very clear message last year. Republicans have the governor's office in both chambers of the legislature for the first time, certainly that I can remember. So by all accounts, this is going to get through. There's also an end to collective bargaining that's part of this, and that's obviously a major issue of debate as well. But moving on to our second martini today, and once again, we find ourselves with a bad martini in the Middle East. But there's a U.S. aspect here. Are you noticing a trend on that? The U.S. planning to go to the U.N., and usually the United States is the one to show some rationality when the U.N. wants to pass a knee-jerk resolution condemning Israel, basically just for existing. But, Hamas launches a jillion rockets in there. Israel has a military response. And, of course, it's Israel, the one that's horrific. Now the U.S. plans to go to the U.N. and back a resolution condemning Israel for constructing in East Jerusalem. Now, obviously, there are others, like the Palestinians, who consider this occupied or disputed territory. But as of right now, it's part of Israel, because when you win things like the Six-Day War, you get to call the terms. And as of right now, that's technically Israeli land, so they can pretty much do whatever they want with it. And for the U.S. or anybody else to tell them what they can or can't do there seems to be pretty ridiculous.
You know, one thing that drove me nuts during the 08 campaign was, in almost every speech by every Democratic contender, there was this argument, the Bush administration has neglected our duties in the Middle East peace process, but as if the whole reason we hadn't seen a lasting peace between Israel and the Palestinians and all their neighbors was we just hadn't tried hard enough. And by golly, if we just paid enough attention, we just, you know, had enough meetings, we did enough shuttle diplomacy, then by golly, it could happen. And it didn't – this entire world viewpoint rejected the notion – one, rejected the notion that one side might be more to blame than the other, and two, that maybe they just have completely different interests and that they're – you know, a common ground is not achievable. I mean, in the end, one side or the other controls Jerusalem. At the end, one point or another controls the holy sites. And one point or another, either exists it as a Jewish state or it doesn't. And that really has come to the points of contention there. And you can't really do a lot of those things halfway. And so now it's kind of interesting that you started seeing after the first 2 years of Obama trying hard and not getting terribly far, partially because they came into these, you know, basic fundamental existential issues to Israel that, you know, Netanyahu was just not really willing to compromise on. I wonder if we're seeing not pouting on the part of the administration, but some sort of sense of, well, we know we're not really going to get a deal, but maybe we can punish the Israelis for not letting us achieve our wonderful idealistic dream of achieving a lasting peace between those two, being so stubborn about their continued existence in that way. I guess what really gets to Obama is that if he had managed to achieve a actual working agreement between the Israelis and Palestinians in 2010, he finally would have achieved his dream of being the first back-to-back Nobel Peace Prize winner.
That's right.
You know, you want to get a bunch of those things. You know, kind of like the Pittsburgh Steelers, for a long time wanted one for the thumb with their Super Bowl rings. You know, anybody can win one of them. It's repeating that really establishes you as a dynasty. And that, I suspect, is what the Obama motivation was.
Well, now he's going to have to win back-to-back again, because obviously he didn't win this last one. But, you know, it's odd that as much criticism as we give the president, and obviously we feel it's justified, he's getting some flack from the left as well. And one of those is the fact that after the whole Tucson tragedy, he didn't make a huge push for greater gun control laws, or at least magazine control laws, in his State of the Union address. But that does not deter New York City Mayor Michael Bloomberg, Democrat turned Republican turned independent. With all his billions of dollars, his way of spreading the message about reducing gun violence and more gun control laws, it's not a Brewster's Millions type nationwide ad campaign. He's not going to buy airtime to make some passionate address. No, he's hiring a truck basically with a billboard on the side to drive around the country listing the number of gun-related deaths the nation has suffered. You know, for a guy who's built a major media empire, this doesn't seem like the greatest marketing tactic in history.
It's a little late to jump on the Scott Brown bandwagon, isn't it, Greg? You know? he won in a big surprise victory and the odds were against him. It must be the truck. to a certain extent, I don't want to credit Bloomberg, but I just want to observe. You look at kind of the grand landscape of politics, and there's really almost nothing breaking the way of the gun control movement. You can almost go back to when Al Gore lost his home state of Tennessee, and there was a perception that really the gun issue is what caused that surprising outcome. And so since then, you've seen Democrats much less rarely associate themselves with gun control. Their big wins in 06 were driven largely on the backs of pro-gun Democrats, and Obama was quick to emphasize that he was a friend of the Second Amendment in his 08 campaign, never mind that his voting record was the precise opposite of all that.
Right.
And even, you know, even in these past cycles, you know, the you know, Democrats in Congress were quick to tell Eric Holder and other folks, we don't want you to touch this issue. We don't want you to rile this up because it will guarantee our doom. Now, as we saw in the midterm elections, the Democrats were doomed anyway. But it's kind of interesting that Bloomberg, in light of this, like, he has to know that he'll never get any help from Democrats in the House and Senate. He has to know that most Democrat governors from purple or red states don't want to touch this. And he, you know, he plods onward. And it's one of those things where you can either say this is an admirable stand on principle or a phenomenal waste of money, or just an interesting sign that Bloomberg when it's fairly clear, this used to be a very divisive issue, and now it's pretty lopsided. There is now a national consensus in favor of a broad interpretation of the Second Amendment, the Americans, you know, right to keep and bear arms. Mike Bloomberg would like to overrule that, and I guess that's kind of the frightening interpretation of this. That, you know, the we've seen in the Heller case, we've seen, you know, time and again that the Constitution does not permit most of the broad-based gun bans that liberals would like to see enacted. And, you know, Mike Bloomberg's response is, so what? You know, I don't really care. You know, ignore the Constitution. And if I have to buy a truck to get that message out, I will do so.
Well, fortunately, I don't believe that it's actually going to accomplish a whole lot. But, you know, he's putting people to work, I guess, and adding to the American economy somehow. We'll find out exactly how, perhaps a little bit later on. Jim, have a great weekend. We'll talk to you on President's Day.
Looking forward to it, Greg.
Jim Garrity of NationalReview.com. I'm Greg Corumbus of Radio America. Please join us Monday for the next 3 Martini Lunch.